Yeah, my name is Allison Leinhardt from Iowa. Love Colorado. Been around some parts in the West. And today it's going to be a lot of kind of overview and then some reflection journaling time, you could call it. And so we'll just kind of, it's kind of directed by y'all today on what we need to go over, questions we still have. If you're like, I have no idea what this is, I can go over some basic concepts and we can kind of move from there. And so, since we have some new faces, if we could just go around and say our names, where we're from, and any initial questions we have, so that way I can try to address them throughout the hour. We'll start here, this one.
I'm Kathy Weeks, I'm from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Here it is. See what I can learn. So, no questions.
I'm Bob Weeks. I tagged along with her. we're talking to these people this morning, and they described some of what they got yesterday, and we thought, well, it sounds interesting, so come and see what it's all about. Cool.
Paul Tilquist from St. Paul. And well, yesterday was our first introduction. So we're back for more.
I'm Callie Mabry. I am from Colorado. I guess I'm interested in like ideas for further reading or further learning about ecofeminist theology.
Yeah. Awesome. And I can give resources if anyone has certain questions about certain aspects of this, of the topic. So, yeah, do that.
Hi, I'm Peg Carlson Hoffman, and I missed the beginning of the week, and I am really happy to be back. And Paul Tilquist and Ruth, have I ever actually met you before?
We've met in Minnesota.
Okay, yeah. In Minnesota.
At a Holden gathering.
Okay, like you kind of live in my memory.
Well, I am.
Than life. Yeah.
I'm Roger Anderson's sister.
Okay, and
they sent greetings to you.
Oh, great.
On Sunday.
That's really wonderful.
Yeah.
So, if these two were intrigued, I like all of them.
Yeah, you two are good recruiters.
People. No, and we were really thrilled to have you. So, great.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to start off with some scripture passage just to sort of frame our conversation. And this comes from Revelation, and I chose it because it's the last book of the Bible and it's our last session. And I was like, we'll go together in some way. So chapter 22, verses 1 through 5, read, "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their forehead. And night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever." So another reason why I chose this set of verses is you can see a lot of nature imagery for end times, and you can see also a lot of inclusion of what's going to happen to us humans in the end times. And so that kind of goes along with Wednesday. We looked at a lot of scripture, and God, when he made a covenant with Noah, included the natural world in the covenant. So you see, whenever God talks about covenants and creating relationships with humans, the natural world is also included in that as well. And so that kind of helps us reframe how we look at our relationship with the natural world and the more holistic, symbiotic relationship that can happen between the two. So, another thing I wanted to ask before I went over some big themes is, I guess it would be you two, if you had used the call to action yesterday, if there was any further thoughts If you remember, that weekend.
Yes, we didn't continue to talk about that.
Yeah.
We did write it down.
No, I don't remember.
What does, what does it mean to cultivate better soil?
Mm-hmm.
And better soil were the, oh, for better food, and better soil were the blood of people.
Yeah. Or, yeah, Sally, if there was any further thoughts about that, or if that influenced your outlook at all. If not, we could move on. I understand it was just yesterday.
Right.
We will continue to
move on.
We will move on then. Sounds good. All right, so some basic overviews of ecofeminist theology. I'll just kind of hit like two or three main points from each day so that we're all caught up and then ready for our reflection exercise. And so, ecofeminist theology. My favorite reaction to this phrase has been, well, that's novel. yeah, it definitely encompasses a lot of stuff and thought. And so, ecofeminism looks at the interrelated domination of women in nature. You can see this particularly through the term Mother Nature, and how nature is often given feminine qualities, and both are seen as sort of this thing that needs to be controlled. And a good example of that is sort of suburban lawns are all about controlling nature. You have a non-native grass species and you mow it, and all the trees and landscaping is often human made and made to look a certain way to be appeasing to the eye. And also especially like 1950s suburbia, you can think about women were to remain in that controlled environment, in the home. So that is definitely a good example of how we've tried to control both women and the natural environment traditionally throughout the ages. And another point, if you think about what are some very divisive political topics right now, it's what can women do with their bodies, like reproductive rights, and what are we supposed to do with different environmental concerns. So they're very divisive things politically, and I think it also points to people grappling with the question of this interrelated domination of both women and nature. And so where the theology piece comes in is how are we as people of faith to respond? So particularly if we have this holy text that's seeped in a patriarchal tradition, how do we sort of recognize that tradition and look past it, but then still gather the holy truths that are there? And how do we balance that out? Also, the theological piece is looking at where the church has been complicit in this interrelated domination of women in nature, and where we can sort of combat that. And so I've talked a lot about domination, and a helpful term that you can think about is logic of domination. This term was coined by Karen Warren, and it relates to this in that this idea that there's a hierarchy based off race, gender, sexual orientation, etc., and those higher on the totem pole dominate those lower on the totem pole, and that's how society functions. Sort of, relying on undervalued labor from either women or people of color, and using that to try to make goods cheaper. Are people seeing where I'm going with this? Yes. Okay. I'll take the silence as a yes. And so another helpful analogy to think about ecofeminist theology is as a roundabout. You got a lot of streets coming in, coming out, a lot of cars circling around, and sometimes you shut down a street and repave it, Other times new alleyways pop up that you didn't really see coming, but they're there, and it's just sort of a really fun mixture of thoughts and ways to look at the world. And so in our first session, we talked a lot about how ecofeminist theology is a lot about reframing. Which I think is really helpful because, again, some people get their feathers a little bit ruffled when you talk about this interrelated domination of women in nature. Like, they may not, some people may see certain things as issues that other people don't. And so I think something really helpful is it's a reframing. It's not this new, like, feminist thought that's coming to dominate your previous thought. It's just simply a reframing of how you look at both the natural world and women and just people in general. And so also a reframing of your theological view of where is God in all of this. So there are five main ways to engage in this reframing in the roundabout of ecofeminist theology. And the first is you can either look at the whole of the system, so sort of what this is, like big overview, kind of look at the forest, not the trees sort of situation. Or you can look at the different parts. So you can look at it. That's what we did a lot on Tuesday and Wednesday, is we concentrated on the ecological side, that part, or we looked at the feminist side, that part. So that's more of looking at the trees than the forest. And so it's important to keep a balanced view between the whole and the parts of this roundabout and how it all works together and influences different parts of our lives. And so the second way you can engage in this reframing is biblical studies. And so, again, looking at how and why the text was written, so possibly the biases that the author may have had, who the author was writing for. For instance, I believe the Bible was written by mostly men, or men, and men that are in positions of religious power. And so how does that influence how they may have written the text, and then subsequently how we read the text? And so I think once we understand the underlying background of the text, we can then re-engage through an ecofeminist lens and sort of reinterpret it, again, acknowledging the past of the text that may not be relevant to today, but still see the holy truths that are within it. Sort of the gems that still stand out even beyond the biases of the author. And then the third way is multicultural and multi-religious perspective. We looked a lot about this yesterday. And so ecofeminism, for me as a white woman in America, is going to be very different for ecofeminist theology for a woman living in the slums of India, for example. So, like, I gave some examples of how a lot of women in India are very against deforestation and rivers being dammed, because if that happens, then they can't feed their kids. Whereas in my situation, I'm not, whether or not I can feed my family isn't impacted so much by that, because we have, like, grocery stores and the infrastructure is different. And so I would be more concerned about things like car emissions, perhaps, or like getting people to recycle, that sort of thing, that wouldn't perhaps be quite as relevant in a different context in a different country. And then the multi-religious perspective is branching this beyond Christian faith. And so you can have ecofeminist theology from a Native American spiritualities perspective, a Hindu perspective. Just sort of any religious tradition you want can have this reframing. It's pretty cool. I was saying yesterday, unfortunately, I don't know much about the multi-religious perspective, but again, I can point you to resources if that's something you want to further explore. And let's see, the fourth way you can plug into it. Let me consult my notes real quick. Is liberation theology. So who here knows a bit about liberation theology? All right, can you just give me
a little bit?
What is your little bit?
Liberation, certainly of the poor, especially in South America, there were a lot of movements. I think yesterday I talked a little bit about Pope Francis, when he was a priest, was very concerned. But I think we agreed that it was probably more of a male perspective than a global perspective on the part of Francis.
Mm-hmm.
So it is liberation of the poor, freeing of the poor. That's my little bit.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, and so along with that, liberation theology, yes, started in South America, and it was like, who is Jesus for the poor? And would Jesus, kind of again calling out the church and being complicit against this domination of people of lower class, and saying, the church would help the people of lower class. Like, why are you in this hierarchy game with like political leaders and government leaders, and continuing this logic of domination in Latin America? And so where ecofeminism comes in is, again, it's from a very male perspective. They look at class, but they ignore gender. And so a lot of ecofeminist theologians who in South America who were around when liberation theology was starting were like, okay, you need to include gender, you need to include sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. So they just kind of push the boundaries further on what liberation theology could be. And so a way it interacts with this is, again, just taking into account gender and class a little bit, because lower class people are more impacted by environmental harm. So are we all following me on where that interacts with liberation theology?
There was a great conflict, as you're talking, between priests who were promoting, if you will, liberation theology and the power structure. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of name-calling. They're communists, and, you know, they're trying to upset the system, and, you know.
Yeah.
So it became kind of a political thing. It got way off course because of politics.
Yeah, and the church has more influence, particularly the Catholic Church, right, in that area. And I think it's interesting, with the Catholic Church and with political structures, you see a lot of parallels. Like, there's the Pope, there's the President, there's Cardinals, there's the Cabinet. You know, you can draw some lines there. And so I think for the Catholic Church, particularly to engage with it, they have to go through that extra layer of what their church system looks like. But I mean, that could be any denomination as well. I think the Lutheran Church is structured very similarly. So just perhaps with a little less power than the Catholic Church. Like Oscar Romero, I believe, he was murdered for being involved with liberation theology while he was giving mass. Kind of sad. Kind of sad, actually. But yeah, that points to the conflict that was within the church that was happening at that time. And then the fifth way of a refrain can engage with ecofeminist theology is through ecofeminist spiritualities. And so this kind of ties into the multi-religious perspective, in which some groups of women are creating worship services that are framed around ecofeminist theology, so using a lot more feminine imagery, perhaps a goddess image would work for them. This also ties into some pagan or Wiccan spiritualities and how they can also adopt an ecofeminist theology probably a little bit more easily than Christianity could, because their theology is a bit more fluid between genders. But yeah, overall there's a lot of stuff in this roundabout in which to engage the reframing of our theology and of our faith through an ecofeminist lens. So that was a lot of what we went over day one. And so
that was day one?
Day one. Day one was heavy. The rest should go a little bit quicker. Yeah, because day two looked at the feminist side. So particularly ecofeminist theology came out of the feminist theology branch through Rosemary Radford Reuther. She... I can't talk right at the same time. There we go. Some feminist theologians were starting to connect women and nature together, but she was probably the first theologian in about probably the 60s and 80s that started to explicitly write from an ecofeminist lens. Her book, Gaia and God, is a really good resource if you want sort of definitely a jumping off point for the history of ecofeminist theology and how that came to be.
Guy and God?
Gaia.
Oh, Gaia. Okay. I'm trying to figure out how Gaia and God
work. Yeah. Gaia is, I believe it's James Lovelock has a Gaia theory that kind of views the earth as, I think he personifies the earth as Gaia a little bit and uses that to kind of, again, reframe how we interact with the natural world.
How is Gaia defined? What is Gaia?
Gaia is the natural world.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Rosemary Radford Reuther looks at it from more of a theological perspective. James Lovelock, where the term Gaia originated from, would look at it from more of a scientific perspective and look at Gaia through like the evolutionary process and the like continual, like, not scientists, so I'm struggling to, the continual like weather patterns and stuff that's happening today. Does that make sense? And so, yeah, we looked at, that was more, and then we looked at how we could reinterpret God, Jesus, Trinity through a feminist, ecofeminist lens, and again, reframe it, and what that would mean for how we did church today. And so, that was day two. Day three, we concentrated on the ecological side, and so we looked at a lot of the environmental movement that was starting around the same time as second wave feminism in, again, the 1960s through about the 1980s. And particularly the protests in Warren County, North Carolina, and how there was, that was a largely African-American population in that county, and there was going to be a toxic dump put there, and they were protesting that and saying, you put toxic dumps in African-American communities all the time, and it leaches into our water and impacts our health, and definitely pointing towards the environmental racism piece, and how, again, those lower on the totem pole in this logic of domination, that includes race, gender, etc., receive the most environmental harm. That comes from where do you place dumps, where do you dam rivers, etc., etc. And so that day we looked at scripture from more of an ecological lens, and I didn't even intend for this to happen, but it was really fascinating how I picked out two Old Testament, two New Testament pieces of scripture, and almost in all of them, when Jesus or God was addressing people, there was this sort of parallel natural world component in it. And if you're interested what verses I had, I can pull those up for you later. And yeah, that was really cool. So again, sort of reframing, okay, if you look at the scripture, there is. God talks about humans. God also talks about the natural world, and what does that mean with how we interact with the natural world? And so day four was different context, and so in particular, we looked at ecofeminism from a global perspective. So again, it will be different for a woman in the fishing industry in Canada. Ecofeminist theology would be different for how she interacts with it than for me, than for a woman living in India, than for a woman living in Tanzania. You know, different contexts have different reactions to this reframing of the logic of domination and how the logic of domination has existed in their society. But in particular, again, we looked at eco-womanism, which started in the U.S. So does anyone from yesterday remember what womanism is? Or can give a brief skill? Yeah.
It's looking at how feminism was kind of predominantly brought up by white women, and then eco-womanism looks at it from the perspective of how that intersects with race. I think particularly in the African American community.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that word till yesterday.
Yeah.
And don't totally understand it, but...
So probably the simplest, the most boiled down definition is it's theology. So just womanism on its own is from the black woman's perspective. So you could have eco-womanism, so that ecology from the black woman's perspective. You kind of have, I had a professor that argued that womanism is inherently theological because it came out of theological circles. But today you can also have like more secular womanism. So I'll say for womanist theology, like what is God from the black woman's perspective? Like if your history is being brought over to this country as slaves and the Bible was used as justification for why you should be a slave, how does that, that's going to impact how you look at the Bible today. Like if this supposed holy text has been used to have domination over you and your community for centuries, that's going to impact how you look at it. And how, again, how do you find, if you decide to continue with the faith, how do you find those holy truths within that mess of human sin? So yeah, you could have, I'm trying to think of another example. Yeah. So like, a big thing now is also like, natural hair and having that not be policed so much. So New York, I think city, I don't believe the whole state enacted laws where people can't be discriminated against for having cornrows or natural like afros. Because before, that was seen as like, oh, you're looking too black and you want to fit in this white dominant society. So you could have hair care from a womanist perspective and that sort of thing. Are we all kind of following along with womanist? Do we have any, are we seeing the dots connecting? I see some like furrowed brows, so I want to make sure it's like thinking and not question.
Well, it's just a piece in the news in the last week or two or month about women now being, black women being allowed to have cornrows, just what you described, cornrows and their own style of hair in the workplace. Can't remember where it was, but yeah.
Well, I think the important thing about that is it really points to how insidious this hierarchy has been over time, especially from a woman's point of view, in that you can't even wear your hair naturally the way it grows. I mean, if we talk about being who we are and becoming our fullest self, if you can't even wear your hair how it grows, there's a lot of other underlying things to be looked at too. So,
womanism just kind of tacking on the race component in this logic of domination. And again, that's a really good point of if we want the Christian faith where everyone can be fully known, we're going to have to look at all those pieces of who people are. And so, eco-womanism, in particular, looked at the beauty and burden paradox that womanists have with the environment. So the beauty aspect is there is healing found in nature. We all have this connection with the natural world. But the burden aspect of the paradox is, again, that history of being brought over forcibly to work the land and this negative, distorted connection with the land if that's the whole reason we were put into slavery, was to work the land. And so we also drew the connection between how often black women were raped by their slave masters and how the land was in a way being raped through this overproduction of cotton, and that destroyed a lot of the soil in the South. So I went to school in Atlanta, Georgia, and definitely interesting to see how the impacts of that time period still linger, whether it's through their infrastructure, farming techniques, race relations. Yeah, it's still very relevant, particularly in that part of the country. That was eco-womanism. And that kind of brings us up to today. Do we have any questions over anything I went over? Or any thoughts?
Yeah. I have a question. So you mentioned on, I think, the second day you talked about how you can reframe God and the Trinity from a eco-feminist perspective and how that affects how we do church today. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what was talked about there?
Yeah, so that exercise was based off a book by Yvonne Guevara, who is actually an eco-feminist from Latin America. And so what she does is she looks at each one of those components through an eco-feminist lens. And so for her, it was like looking at Jesus through very much through an embodied way, and how Jesus had a body and like lived and, you know, ate and all these very basic human things, and how that impacts how we treat our body. That just has this disposable thing, but with respect. And for God, it was definitely, and the Trinity, moving beyond the two old men and a bird image for God. opening up the imagery there, and an example of that at work is I had a classmate, I don't know the name of the painting, but someone, the Michelangelo, where God is reaching out to touch Adam's finger, are we all familiar with that? They replaced the two men in that picture with black women, and I had a classmate who was also a black woman, and she said the first time she saw that, she cried, because she was like, wow, the divine in this image, if the divine is portrayed like that, then the divine can live within me, and I can be a deeper person of faith. So it really, imagery, representation is a huge, it's sort of along those lines to answer your question of, how does that change how we view the divine and how we view ourselves within this greater system, the whole, of eco-feminist theology and being a person of faith?
I don't know if a Franciscan priest like Richard Rohr can be identified as an eco-feminist, but so many of the things that you have talked about really reflect some of his writing, but in particular the Trinity. And when you talked about the roundabout, Richard Rohr and the Trinity, and he does not view the Trinity as two old men and a bird. I mean, it is a flow of the energy that goes from one into the other, and there's not this specific identification of God, male, dominant, Christ, male, spirit. I mean, it's just, there's a flow, and that's what I get from your presentation, it is a flow, and sometimes we interrupt the flow, and domination comes in, becomes the prevalent model instead of this flow.
Yeah, that flow is a really good way to look at it. I'm remembering earlier I talked about how ecofeminist theology looked at more, again, a symbiotic, holistic flow relationship between the divine, the natural world, and who we are as people. For sure. And again, instead of this domination, like box hierarchy look.
I think an old Franciscan can be an ecofeminist. Richard Rohr has been a really a strong voice for opening up that language, and he was highly influenced by Cynthia Bourgeau and her the power of the Trinity and what was really underneath. The way we've described it over time has not done it very well, it serves us very well. And I think what one of the things that is important, it's like important for Holden, it's important for the church, is language. Some of this we don't have language. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I listened to all of us struggle to try to put some of the things that we have experienced ourselves into language, and we don't have it. And I think that's why it's really important to struggle through the words and to, like, trip over ourselves and mm-hmm. to say, it feels like flow, but I don't really know what it means. So, I mean, I think that's okay. I think it's just all part of what is trying to rise and trying to help that rise instead of just using our own particular models that have sent everybody out of the church.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then trying to figure out what we're talking about.
Yeah. Language has come up repeatedly throughout the week, so yeah, I'm going to include that in as a big piece of how do we respond and what the heft of language has to do with how we respond. Yeah, emphasis on that. And I also want to emphasize that ecofeminist theology is an embodied theology, and that comes out of the feminist tradition a little bit in that it's concerned with our everyday reality, our bodies, how we live in our bodies, how we feed our bodies, how our bodies interact and experience the world as well. So that'll connect you with people. Some hesitant nods. Okay. So what I'm going to have us do next is kind of take all this that's kind of, hopefully, kind of running around our brains a little bit and write it out. So a journal reflection. I have pens and paper if you need it. So who needs pens and paper? We need...
I can use your book.
The option, people want that. Okay. Anyone else need a pen or paper? Okay. So, for our reflection journal time, I have some things, some little pointers for ways to guide you in your thinking, and then, but if you end up writing something that goes a little off track, that is perfectly fine. This is for you and your processing of, again, how this can become embodied in your real life and kind of change how you kind of start the reframing process that this ecofeminist theology asks of people. So this is, the first point is thoughts or questions you had before this class. We kind of went over that, but again, you can reiterate that. Thoughts and questions you have now. Hmm. ways you can, and I'll write these on the board, so if you miss them, they'll be up here. Ways you can include the reframing that ecofeminist theology has for your personal life. This is very much just you, kind of in your brain question. How this reframing can interact with your religious center or your church. And if you don't have one of those, how it interacts with your community or the neighborhood you live in. And yeah, community is the last piece as well. So religious center or community, or if you have a religious center, you get to do double duty with religious center and community. So get that extra responsibility. All right, so we're gonna spend 5-10-ish minutes. However, when I see pens stop moving, that's when we'll start to share. All right, so go ahead. I'll do this as well after I write down the points on the board. Actually, would it be more helpful to have this on the board, or would it be more helpful to have the questions? Or does it not?
Probably that.
Okay. So if you need the questions reiterated, I can come by and do that as well. Seeing pens start to slow down, so if you want to just finish up whatever thought you were on. So, just come together and kind of share our reflections on what we had about this, and maybe through sharing ideas we have of how we can enact this further, inspire other people as well. And so the reason I'm ending with this is I end each session with a call to action, because again, ecofeminist theology is about orthodoxy, so right thought, but also orthopraxy, so right practice. And the idea is this shouldn't just be things we talk about here, but again, it should be enacted in our lives. So this is your big final call to action ending today's session. So, and if your call to action doesn't need to be big, it can just be like, I'm just going to explore this further. Or it can be as big as, I'm going to mention, suggest ecological things to the church board, you know. So I'm excited to see what y'all put down. So, we already kind of went over thoughts and questions before the class. But are there any thoughts and questions now that you've had a chance to write out something that you would want to discuss further?
Well, I found myself thinking, before I didn't fully understand what the term even meant, but as you were talking and so on, when you mentioned about other faiths, you alluded to the Native American. Mm. And I found myself already thinking, even before you mentioned that, the connection with the Native Americans and their view of nature and ecology and so on. And with the Christian view, you know, we tend to think that we are called by God to be caretakers of the creation. And in fact, you know, in Genesis, it says that God put man in the garden to care for it, mm-hmm. you know, and that's always been kind of our view. Where the Native American, they viewed it as we are simply part of creation. We are included with what was created, and we are just part of it. And they didn't see that idea that man is dominant or over the other animals or anything. Mm-hmm. They saw everything as more equal. And that we need to act in harmony with what's going on in nature and other animals and so on. And I guess I have, you know, studied that some. I would like to study it more in terms of their views. And of course, the different tribes had a little bit different views on that. But and also, as I recall in what I heard, they did have kind of a feminist view of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
More so than the Christian view of, you know, God the Father.
Yeah, it is important to note that even though that we, a lot of times Christians view like we are the caretakers of the earth and like the earth needs us, the earth doesn't really need us. In fact, sometimes the earth would be better without us.
Right.
So yeah, definitely more of a, we are a participant in this world than we are like the ones that have to kind of control everything. For sure. And that kind of points to when looking at scripture, a lot of the times when God is making a covenant, it's with us and the natural world, almost implying that the natural world, we are part of it, and we aren't necessarily like this super separated
right.
entity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other thoughts or questions people have now?
I haven't thought about this for months. My son's favorite bumper sticker from some years back was "Subvert the Dominant Paradigm." Well, you brought it to mind.
Yeah.
Today, boy, I circled it, and you know, it's just.
Write that down. That is great.
Subvert the dominant paradigm.
How many people read that and went home and looked it up?
Well, I questioned it at the time, trying to, you know, put that into my head, but wow, your couple of questions or your presentations.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a writer for the logic of domination? Did you put a writer?
So the term was coined by Karen Warren.
Karen Warren.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's used a lot in, well, Heather Eaton talks about it in her book and kind of uses it as a framing as well. So, yeah, those are two names if you want to look into it more. Yeah, subvert the dominant paradigm, kind of like stick it to the man in really fancy terms. So, yeah. I'm going to keep that phrase. Awesome. Moving on to our next point of ways to include reframing in personal life or for oneself. Any thoughts on that? I put things like continue to read up, listen to other voices, and for me, I'm really good at pushing boundaries, but sometimes I need to respect boundaries of where people are at with certain ideas. So for me, it's kind of that balance is something I can continue to work on in this reframing as well. Because I don't want to be so forceful that I'm falling into this, like, my view needs to dominate your view sort of thing. And so kind of keeping that in balance. Does anyone else have any other thoughts about it? They can be very different from mine.
I wrote down just for me personally, it's helpful to think about kind of the images I have in my head associated with God and also like the language I use around that. And so it's helpful for me to think of God as so much bigger than like human understandings of gender. So it helps me to like say things like, instead of using like he, him, his pronouns for God, it helps me to just think of like God as this thing that's like bigger than just this space Santa in the sky, that like there's so much more to God than I can put my human brain around. Yeah, just the language and imagery I use for myself is important.
I wrote about language too. I think language is so important, but it's so slowly changed in the church. We have a new pastor, and that's one of my things I'm going to go talk to him about.
Yeah.
Is that, even beginning to change the language in our liturgy, and I think it's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a very important part of reframing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nadia Boltz-Weber, if you all are familiar with her, she was the first one that like I saw use both he and she language for God interchangeably, and she's like a very recent, still relevant person. You wish that pastors from years past would have started that. Yeah, but it is a very new thing, and I think for including a lot of LGBTQ people as well, language is going to be very important, particularly for trans or non-binary folks, and how they could possibly feel alienated from certain language as well.
Women as well.
Hello. Yeah. We're created in the image of God, but all we see is he and him. Yeah, exactly. It's hard to feel that. Yeah. I remember being, I think, like 7 years old, and I asked my mom, I'm like, why wasn't Jesus a girl? I'm a girl. So even like as a young kid, it has a big impact even with kids and how people come up in the church. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyone else? How about reframing in religious centers? So we kind of touched on that with language, how we can think about language ourselves and also approach like pastors with using different language. Did anyone else have any other thoughts or ideas of how this reframing could have an impact in either how they engage with their church or how their church could interact with the world or religious center?
Years ago in the LCA, there was a movement of kind of your story, my story. It was a whole thing. And I wrote down a note to myself, ask questions of mutual explorers and hear their story. Because I really try not to be my way or the highway, but it's pretty easy to think that I have grasped now the truth, and I really want to share it with you.
Yeah.
But to just hear people's stories and how the language that they use in a non-judgmental way, just to hear it out, I think would be helpful in our churches and our congregations.
Yeah. Approaching people in situations with a sense of curiosity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, yeah. Be curious.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Because if you're curious, you tend not to have any agendas as well. You just are more open to learn from other people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's huge. And then listening to the language they use. Yeah, like you said. Yeah.
I think I really think a lot about we live in suburbia. Mm-hmm. We have a well manicured, and we live, it's not all manicured, but we certainly close to the house is manicured and controlled.
Mm-hmm.
You protest against it.
I do it all the time. I do, but I don't always win. And but it's all around us. How how do we, in a city or the suburbs, how do we change our relationship with nature?
I'm living with my parents right now, and they live in suburbia, and looking at a reframing in that context can be challenging, because especially if you have different like housing ordinances on how your lawn's supposed to look.
Not quite that tight, but yeah.
Because then if you want to maybe incorporate more natural plants, then you've got to like go through a whole like committee. And it can be a struggle. Yeah. Yeah. Looking at environmental options for churches, I found a lot of churches are like still using styrofoam cups for coffee. That just like kills me every time. Or just like basic recycling needs for different like infrastructure stuff like that is the things I think about as well. So yeah, but again, to enact change in that, it requires going through a committee and a reframing. So yeah. Anyone else? All right, and then communities, so neighborhoods, if you're part of any clubs, your family as well, that can be tough. Any sort of thoughts there?
Well, I never got that.
Oh, you never got it. Oh. Oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure. Like, is a like
no?
Like, is it a thought?
Oh no, no, it's not a. It's not a.
Okay. Okay. Good. Just want to clarify. Well, we can leave that as your final call to action. Something to further think about. For me, it was similar to the church of. Kind of looking at the infrastructure and how it's built and how different things are controlled, whether everything's built for trash, whether everything's built, if there are recycling or environmental component or compost components built into how we get rid of our waste, or what are ways, also programs to empower women and girls in the community, like Girls on the Run is a example of that. My family's a big runner, so we like to get young females out running and enjoying nature that way too. So kind of investing and looking at those different systems in our society.
I think it's important too, to like, it's so important to get the infrastructure within a church or a community set up to recycle or have native plants or whatever, and sometimes the big barrier is the laws or the rules that are in place. And so it's also important to like to change those and make that change so that it's not just one person planting a garden or like one place that's recycling, but make it easier for everyone to recycle or everyone to buy solar panels. And so some of that work has to take place in like City Hall or at the state capitol, and I think that's an important piece too.
Accessibility, I'm right in the middle. Make it the norm. Yeah. Like I said earlier, what are the most politically divisive topics? The environment, and not, maybe not the most politically divisive, but some of these more ones are around women and around the environment.
So I can think of one thing that everybody who lives in suburbia can do is answer. I think it, Chet Myers has the 10 questions or the 35 questions. Starts out with, what's the name of your watershed in your neighborhood? You know, silly, the things that seem silly, like which way is north? What are the first plants that bloom in the spring? What, you know, I mean, there's a list of things that you can know, like where does your water come from? Where does your sewer waste go? How's it processed? I mean, like, to know those things it's when we don't know them that we feel no connection to them, and then we don't care about them. So it's like really important to know what your watershed is and where things come from and where things go, and what blooms and what five natural plants that grow in your neighborhood that you could eat, and all of those things. So
what was
who's
that?
The writer?
Yeah,
Chet Myers.
C-A-G-N.
Chet Myers.
Chet.
Yeah. Okay. He'll be here next year.
Oh, okay.
M-Y or M-E-Y?
M-E-Y.
And then what was his, just like...
I think it's called 35 questions or 10 questions.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
If you do that, you will find those questions. If you kind of mess around, you'll find them.
Yeah, awesome. So, thank you all for joining me today.
Awesome.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.